All right, just to let you know, I appreciate the ongoing prayers, obviously, for Linda. We have an appointment tomorrow morning, so hopefully we will find out something then that will give us some idea of which direction to head from there. Hopefully not another surgery, but if need be, that's what we will do. So certainly if you'd pray about that, I'd appreciate it. Let's see, I don't know what time the appointment is. It's in the morning, I believe, though, so that's a nice issue. Okay, let's make sure you are in fellowship. Somebody got you out, now's the time to rebound. Let's prepare to move on here. Dealing with, and we really have three chapters of information that is primarily concerned with the same subject. The first five verses of this really are somewhat of an introductory situation because Paul's doing is explaining his view, his own thinking, what he actually believes in terms of his countrymen, because they have constantly attacked him on any number of fronts of being anti-Semitic, anti-patriotic, anti-Israel, anti-temple, anti-Jerusalem. Because, again, Paul and the doctrine that was being advocated said that these things weren't issues and anti-law. And that's another big deal, of course, the Mosaic Law. That's a huge part of what's going on here. When you notice there in Acts, those challenges that they made against him in Acts 21 there, when they said, this man is doing blah, 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 preaches against all men, to all men everywhere, against our people. Well, I didn't stop and mention that first session, but the reality is what they're accusing him of is selling out the Jews to the Gentiles. The all men everywhere would be the antithesis to our people, the Jews. And so Paul was looked at as being anti-Jewish, anti-law, anti-temple, because he said these things don't ultimately matter. It's one's personal relationship with God. But you're in a society that's been ingrained with this for hundreds and thousands of years. I mean, the first temple, Solomon's temple, was built circa 950 BC, somewhere in there. So, I mean, they've had the temple. I mean, of course, it fell into disrepair and got sacked at the taking of Jerusalem under Nebuchadnezzar there, destroyed. But they had rebuilt it. And they were continually working on it. And that was the focal point of their religion. So to say anything against the temple. But if you look there and you notice now here in Acts 21, and I don't have my Bible with me. I wish I did. But normally I have some chronological notes in here as to exactly when this is and all of that. But this is right before Paul goes into the Roman imprisonment, which is about 60 A.D. So his Roman imprisonment went from 60 to 62 A.D. So this is the arrest in the temple before he gets to Rome, of course. Now it takes him, as you know, he takes kind of a circuitous route to get to Rome, and it wasn't that much fun. But if you look at those charges that they leveled against him there, and you look at what was said about Stephen. Now, Stephen was essentially a nobody. Stephen shows up in the book of Acts, but he was certainly not among the frontline apostles. Now, he may have been a part of that larger group that followed Jesus. We don't know for certain. Or if he just converted after, because there were a lot of conversions to Christianity after the resurrection. Not because they believed the resurrection per se. That's not. I mean, it wasn't just that action. But having found all this truth out, I mean, there's a new, there's a lot of new revelation going on there. Well, Stephen, verse 8 of Acts chapter 6, was full of grace and power, performing great wonders and signs among the people. But some men from what was called the synagogue of the freedmen, including both Cyrenians and Alexandrians, and some from Cilicia and Asia, rose up and argued with Stephen. But they were unable to cope with the wisdom and the spirit with which he was speaking. And that's what you want to do. If you ever have to overpower your opponent, you want to do them with wisdom and the spirit. That they aren't able to fully, they can't really answer you. That will eventually, for most people, they'll eventually finally shut up and go away. Well, now these guys didn't. There are other people, however, when you cross them and put them in their place and straighten them out, and you're speaking the truth and all of that, they won't go away. They're going to get revenge. They're going to try to take you down. But again, these people just serve as, they may rage against God and His plan, but it doesn't stop it. And so they were unable to cope with this. And they secretly induced men to say, "We have heard him speak blasphemous words against Moses and against God." Oh, so he's a blasphemer? Our great lawgiver, he rejects. And then in verse 13, and they put forth false witnesses. They dragged him up. And this is a, you know, this is a kidnapping, an abduction, in broad daylight, by the way. And they drag him into the temple and bring him before the council. And they put false witnesses who said, "This man incessantly speaks against this holy place and against the law." Doesn't that sound very similar to what Paul was accused of in Acts? And of course, that's getting close to 60 AD. This is not... Stop. Don't do this. Review later. Don't show again. Fine. Technology. I can't stay in fellowship with a tablet. Then you expect me to be able to study and teach. So where was I before that thing just completely? But again, this sounds very much like what Paul was accused of. But this is not too long after 33 AD. This is, you know, probably circa 35 AD. So 25 years later, almost, the same charges are still being leveled against Christians. And this continues to be a problem and will grow in terms of persecution in the Roman Empire, in that other charges will be added to them that are not strictly Jewish charges. They will be accused of being unpatriotic to the empire. They will be accused of being anti-Caesar. They will be accused of not wanting to pay taxes. Who wants to pay taxes? But again, the Roman Empire, that was a big deal. Yeah, that's a big deal to do in America. You're supposed to pay your taxes. You should. But if they catch you not paying your taxes, it will not go well with you. They do not take kindly to that. Well, the Romans took even less kindly to it. And so these charges, this continued to boil, and it bubbled over out of the Jewish sort of milieu in which it was in to encompass the Roman Empire. And they had to deal with this, these charges, as everywhere they went, Christians had to deal with this. That they were unpatriotic, they didn't like Caesar, they wouldn't say Caesar was Lord, they believed in another god. Essentially, they worshipped a competing king, we might say. But Jesus had told them, my kingdom is not of this world. Christians should know that. We're not here to reform the devil's world. And in the next 10 months or so, you are going to have it shoved down your throat about how politics is going to change this world. That's all we're going to hear for the next year. Change we can believe in. Yeah, we got some of that, didn't we? We got socialized medicine. That's what the Democrats have wanted for years. Now we've got it. And how are we doing? Well, we'll see in about 3 years. There's going to be a real litmus test coming up here in about 3 years. Because they're introducing so many sick people into this system that otherwise we're uninsurable. I'm glad they can get help. I'm compassionate. I'm for that. But... Is it the taxpayer's responsibility to do this? And of course, the answer to that is no. So again, Paul is dealing with all of this, these charges that he's an anti-Semite, that he's against the temple. And you can imagine how easy it is during an environment like this for them to go out and get people stirred up quick. Because nothing gets people going more than rah-rah patriotism. What I like to call pseudo-patriotism, in fact. That it isn't really true patriotism. This idea of my country, right or wrong, that is a very bad view for a Christian in any dispensation to take. That a Christian has to be careful. He's not a part of this world system. He's not designed to fit into it. And to embrace it as, oh, well, this is just the way it is, and my country never makes mistakes. Yes, our country has a history of making mistakes, and the whistleblowers end up in prison. They silence them pretty well. Anybody heard of Assange lately? Where's he nowadays? What happened? And I'm not saying that there aren't people out there doing bad things, but again, our government's been involved in some pretty bad stuff that they don't want you to know about. I was astonished when I went back and read that book, The Hope of the Wicked. I looked at it, and even back then, and this was early 90s or mid-90s, if I remember right. He even had a blurb in there that there was a massive... underground movement, and the government was accumulating massive evidence of cell phones, phone conversations, tapping everything, illegal, no due process, none of this stuff. And he points out this has been going on for 15, 20 years now. 25 maybe even. So they don't want you to know that kind of stuff. And so if you're going to support the country no matter what, well, a Christian has to draw a line, and it has to be a moral line, for one thing. We can't condone immorality. We can't condone murder of people. We cannot condone the wholesale selling out of certain segments of society or civilizations. And, you know, the kind of things we've done, like in Iraq, invading a country, we knew they didn't have any weapons. We knew whatever weapons they had, we'd sold them. But they don't bother telling you that, because I need to see a heartwarming story about a kitty cat on the news, because they don't want to tell me what's really going on. And they don't want that. People don't generally want to know either, frankly. The American public doesn't want to know this stuff. So, like Paul, you face these situations where you may be viewed as a traitor. You know, I'm not a traitor. We embrace standards and morality of right and wrong and have consciences. And no, we can't just willy-nilly lay hands on everything that comes along, including our own country sometimes. We have to look at things objectively and deal with those types of things. Well, as we go here, again, we've stopped off here. We left off here with about point 24. The most obvious possibility about why, again, he doesn't say explicitly here, but I think enough is said. You can read between the lines and see what's going on here. Paul knows the vast majority of his countrymen are in unbelief. That bothers him. It bothers me that most of our country is filled up with religious nonsense. And what passes off as normal, you know, I read this article. I don't even know why it was there. I don't even know how it, you know, it was one of those pop-up things, or it was on some site I looked at or something. And when Bruce Jenner, because that's who he is, goes down to, I guess, Texas or somewhere, and he meets with all these pastors of these mega churches, and he's treated like a celebrity. Are you kidding me? Because in the name of the almighty politically correct, we've got to accept everybody, no matter how weird they are. These people are, we meet with him. I wouldn't meet with this person for, say, my life. What are they meeting with him? Why is he given celebrity status? I mean, this is gross. And again, this is passed off, paraded around as normal. And there's nothing normal about what I see on TV most of the time. The only show I really enjoy is The Soup, where they make fun of it. And they canceled it. What are you going to do? Well, again, he doesn't ever really spell this out here. But the reality, he doesn't provide a real explicit explanation. But one obvious possibility, point 24 here, is that Paul's loyalty to his countrymen has been called into question because of his mission to the Gentiles. In 25, there are also the obvious misunderstandings of his theology with regard to the matter of the Mosaic Law, its purpose and function. And they've got issues with the ritual of circumcision. But as we saw there in Romans chapter 7, Paul's teaching correctly puts the law where it should be. The problem was the Jews didn't have the law where it should be. They had the law as a vehicle. You jump in the law and it will take you to glory. That is not the way the law works. The law can only condemn. And so he talks about, and of course, you know, then if you remember in Romans 7, there was a point in here where you kind of wonder, well, is he trying to implicate the law as a problem? And it's not. He's not trying to implicate the law. What he is pointing out is that the sin nature is so incorrigible that there's no answer to it. And the law is so most certainly not the answer. Whatever the answer is to the sin nature, it's incorrigible, permeating nature that permeates every area of your life. We've never lived one second apart from a sin nature. We have no idea what true glory and freedom is like. We've all, as Paul says, I am under bondage. I've been sold under bondage. When Adam fell and generated the sin nature, or that judgment of God that generated the sin nature, everybody got it, everybody died. And there's no good news out of that. There is no good news that ever comes out of that situation. It is unremitting sin and death, sin and death, sin and death, sin and death, sin and death. And that's the nature of the sin nature. And it permeates us. And God graciously, out of the human race, chooses to save some. And that's grace, because nobody deserves it. So he says, as he goes through this, he almost implies the law has a deal. But the law is not the problem, as he says. In Romans 7:8, he said, but the sin nature, taking opportunity through the commandment. It's not that the commandment's problematic. The problem is the sin nature is so devious and so corrupt that it will use that which is good to accomplish its evil ends and not have any problem doing it. The sin nature itself does not have a conscience, much of one at all. It can't, because it just wants what it wants. Again, that's that selfish, inherently selfish, self-centered part of every one of us that thinks it's all about me. And guess what? It's not all about any of us. So taking opportunity through the commandment. And the commandment, verse 10, which was to result in life. Yeah, that is, if you could obey the commandment, if you could live by the laws of God, you would experience life. But nobody can. Not fully. And that's because of the sin nature. It proved to result in death to me. So one might argue, well, the commandment's part of this. And it is part of it, but an unwitting part of it. An unwilling part of it. The sin nature hijacks the commandment and does with it what it chooses. And he says then, verse 12, so then, the law is holy. The commandment, the individual parts of the law, specifically the one he was talking about in context, was you shall not covet. You don't lust after your neighbor's stuff. That's it. So the commandment is holy, righteous, and good. So did that which is good become a cause of death for me? May it never be. See, Paul never taught that the law had any problems at all. But again, if you're Paul's enemy, you just want to twist and distort his words. You want to present him in a certain light that makes him look guilty. And if that's never happened to you in life, I hope it never does. But if it does, guess what? Your enemies won't care. They will not hesitate, in many cases, to stooping to the most nefarious of tactics. And that's what Paul's enemies did. But these men are enemies of God as well. It's not just that they're enemies of Paul. These are people who are enemies of God. These are people who are negative and hostile. They don't want the truth. They want it their way. And not the truth way. But it's however they want it. Well, so again, then there's this obvious misunderstanding about his theology. And I didn't mention it here, but also the matter of the temple, Jerusalem, Israel, what part they're going to play in God's plan going forward. All these are sort of interconnected issues that Paul has to deal with and that his enemies would attack him on. Well, actually 25. There are also obvious misunderstandings, again, of his theology with regard to the matter of the Mosaic law, purpose and function, and the ritual of circumcision. See, Paul didn't advocate circumcision. He didn't advocate against it. He didn't go out and just say, but what he did say was, if you think being circumcised is going to get you into heaven, you're wrong. And that's the same thing we would tell people. If you think taking a little baby, a little newborn, 2 weeks old or whatever, and throwing some water on its forehead is going to get that baby into heaven, you're wrong. It's not. Or that if you go get confirmed, that's going to get you into heaven. It's not. Or if you get baptized, that guarantees you entrance into heaven. It does not. These are all rituals. These are all things that are externals. And Paul's argument is, it's not the external things that really make one a people of God, a person of God, a child of God. It's not these external things that make one a child of God. It's internal. So whatever the internal issue is, it's got to be dealt with there. And that involves salvation. Well, 26, Schreiner has observed that Paul's grief may well be the result of his understanding that the matter of Israel impacts upon the matters of God's faithfulness and honor. Many interpreters have recognized that one can make the argument, and that this is some of what Paul's fighting against here, is again that if God's promises to Israel fall, then what confidence can the church have of God's promises? You can't have any. If God does not fulfill his promises to Israel. But Paul's going to argue that he does. He does fulfill his promises to Israel. But that there are several problems. Number one, not all Israel is Israel. That there is within Israel, that there is within the nation. The mass that is Israel, the nation. That not all those in there, he would say, not all those are necessarily Jews. There are regenerate Jews within racial Israel. That is the nation. Within racial Israel, there are only a remnant, a small portion of regenerate Jews that are believers. And that small portion, God, Paul says, will say, is where God fulfills his promises. And it was always to that small believing portion that the promises were really directed. That one has to make the salvation adjustment to really be a child of God. Where the Jew thought, I am a son of Abraham, I am therefore a child of God. To them, son of Abraham and child of God were synonyms. They're not synonyms. And Paul, of course, points this out. They're not synonyms. And so, Paul's going to argue this on two fronts. First, he's going to say, first, you need to realize that not all Israel is Israel. And that God has always made distinctions within the nation. And this goes as far back as Abraham. God made a distinction between Ishmael and Isaac. And it continued in the next generation. Under Isaac, he made a distinction between Esau and Jacob. God has always made a distinction. Not everybody who's racially a Jew is God's child. And that's of course, their thinking. They think they are. And Paul will have none of that. Well, the bottom line, point 27, is that Paul has recognized that the majority of his countrymen have rejected their own Messiah. And in fact, a fair portion of his countrymen were involved in the murder. The religious leadership was all involved in it. There were exceptions here or there. Suppose that Nicodemus and, say, Joseph of Arimathea, who were part of the council, we presume that they did not give credence to this, that they didn't lay their hands on it. But the entire council, essentially, the religious, the 70 elders, all of them were involved, the biggest majority of them were. And as the leadership goes, as you probably know, should know by now, as the leadership of a nation goes, so goes the nation. And this is why, again, having good leaders is a good thing. But, again, that's what we don't. He's recognized that they've rejected this. And the matter of that rejection must be explained. And this is critical in light of the privileges that God has bestowed on that nation. 28 here, the two Greek terms Paul uses to describe his strong emotions about this matter are lupe and adune. Sorrow and grief. Well, even in English, what do you suppose is the difference between sorrow and grief? To my thinking, they're largely synonyms. I mean, if whatever the subtle differences between them may be, and each one probably has because of the nature of their roots, would have somewhat of a difference. But again, is there really a way to strongly and clearly, this is where in some cases, in doctrinal churches, I've seen big mistakes made. I've seen whole doctrines built on a distinction between two words. Really? First, you better be darn sure that those two words mean two different things all the time. That's what we call a technical term. A word that means the same thing in every context. You can use certain words, they are not technical. It just depends on the situation. Most words are not technical. They don't always mean the same thing all the time. They can be used in different contexts. You can use them as figures of speech. You can use them for literal. You can use them in a narrative function. You could use them poetically. I mean, there's a bunch of ways you can use it. I was listening to a song a guy was singing the other day, and one of the lines in it was, I've got dirt on my hands. Well, I interpret that metaphorically, you know, to mean that he understands he's a sinner. Now, he may not. That he's got some sort of defilement. But then he has another line in the song, and it said, I got dust in my pocket. And I'm thinking, okay, well, what's he mean here? See, clearly, he doesn't mean dust in a hopefully not literal sense. He's walking around with a bunch of dust in his pockets. I presume he's referring to the inherent little value of money. That doesn't normally people keep their money in their pockets. But again, those are seemingly non-technical words. You can't make an argument. If people want to get together and interpret a song and try to argue over the meaning, well, do that to Dylan, you'll go nuts. I mean, he writes all over the place. So, again, these are not necessarily technical terms. So, the prevailing view among those that see a distinction. I'm not certain I see a big distinction in these words. But I will acknowledge that there are people who say they do. Is that the first term refers more to the mental aspects of suffering, pain, sorrow, and grief. While the second term focuses more on the physical aspects of suffering. So that's the way they try to say it, that he's suffering physically and mentally because of it. But is he really saying that, or is the suffering largely spiritual and emotional? I don't think Paul's suffering physical pain because of this, so I don't see this distinction that some of them have made here. I mean, he doesn't say, oh, and I've got, you know, a constant throbbing pain in my side. You know, if it's there, it's probably appendix. You better get that checked out. But, you know, I don't think he's saying I've got physical pain because of this. But here, this is where people try to draw too fine a line. They try to make distinctions that may not even exist. And that's not sound doctrine. Well, 30, however, New Testament usages, and the usages found in the Septuagint. Now, again, the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. So when they translated, and this was circa 200 BC, roughly, somewhere in that vicinity. When they translated, number one, because they're closer to it, and because they were largely Hebrews and Greeks, we assume they had a pretty good feel for what they did. That doesn't always prove to be true. Because you'll see certain things in the Septuagint that are just clearly badly translated. But we do look at the way they used it because it gives us some insight into, okay, well, if the Jews wrote this word, if a Hebrew wrote this, what would that mean to a Greek? And then we got to do it one step further and I say, what does it mean to a 21st century American who's largely removed? That's the pastor's, part of the pastor's job, is to bridge that cultural gap between what we're dealing with and where we are now in time. Because many of these principles, and in fact all of them in the Bible, are pretty much timeless. They're good for every generation. Some are more important at certain times in history. But generally speaking, God's word can be counted on no matter when you live. So the prevailing view is, again, one says mental, the other says physical. But I don't see Paul saying here, I'm hurting physically because of this. I would make a distinction more between, say, emotional pain and spiritual grief. But again, how do you determine that in, or quantify that some way in a person? I don't know that you could. Well, 30, however, again, New Testament usages and others in the Septuagint do not support this distinction. The two are used together in the Septuagint with no discernible difference in meaning. Proverbs 31:6. Give strong drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those who are bitterly distressed. Well, the one perishing is that's the translation of lupe. Well, there they've translated like almost in terms of a destruction. But clearly the idea here is in the context. And then the last one, those who are bitterly distressed, that's the net translation, is dune. In the New American Standard, they translate it perishing, lupe, and whose life is bitter. But in the immediate context, he's talking about the nature of the fact that kings, because in the Semitic world, we have a division of power according to our Constitution. We have executive, judicial, and legislative branches. And these are supposed to provide us checks and balances. How's that working? Not so good. But we have that. Well, in the ancient world, they didn't have that. The king was essentially judge, jury, executioner, lawmaker, all of it. He was where all the power resided. So he says, it's not for kings, verse 4, Lemuel, to drink wine, or for rulers to desire strong drink. For they will drink and forget what is decreed. And they pervert the rights of the afflicted. That's all you need. We should have a new show called Drunk Judge. I'll bet it would sell. I have an idea for a show. We'll call it Drunk Judge. People watch all kinds of weird stuff. We could be rich on this if we just sell the right idea. Well, he says that's the problem. You don't want a drunk judge. You want a judge who keeps the facts of the law before him and understands the legal precedents and all of those other factors. And also deals with the situation before him in terms of whether mercy or leniency is appropriate. You don't ever want a judge who just strictly judges by the law, because there's no room in that. It can only condemn. That's all you could ever do. And to my thinking, you want a judge who has some compassion also, but who sees situations as they are and does enforce the law and recognizes certain things. Are there mitigating circumstances? Yes, this boy stole a loaf of bread from the store, but he hadn't eaten in 4 days. Let's throw him in prison. I'm not advocating for stealing. You have to deal with that. The boy should have to make restitution. Of course, if he hasn't eaten, he probably doesn't have any money either. So, but a judge, you would want a judge, hopefully, I would think, we would want judges that would have some discretion and some understanding. And so he says in this context, you don't drink wine. Who does need to drink wine? As he says, give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to those whose life is bitter. Sedate them. And of course, that's my ringtone. I want to be sedated. But it's not mine now, it's Linda's. So they're saying that there is a time and a place for this, but the time and place is in those people who really, really are going through it. It's not for the king to do that. But again, here, I don't see any big distinction in what he's saying in the first half of this verse. Give strong drink to him who is perishing. This, to me, is synonymous parallelism. And you have various forms of parallelism used in Hebrew poetry, which Proverbs qualifies as Hebrew poetry. I say the strong drink corresponds to the wine, and the perishing, the lupe, corresponds to the life who is bitter, adune. They are essentially just saying the same thing in two different ways. So what's the big distinction? I don't see it. Isaiah 35:10 is another one. The ransom of the Lord will return and will come with joyful shouting to Zion, with everlasting joy upon their heads. They will find gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Well, in that deal there, sorrow and sighing, in that case, they're reversed. Adune comes first. Adune is there. That's sorrow. That's translated by lupe and all the others. And then lupe is translated as sighing. I see the Net Bible translated it as grief and suffering. Well, to me, that there's not enough there to say, well, this means grief, emotional, and physical suffering. I don't know that you have enough in the context to make that argument. So all I'm saying here is, there's a lot to say, but saying that I see these terms as being pretty much synonymous. And that he's just stating in a very strong way that I really agonize over this. This isn't just something, it's not some little minor isolated incident with me. This is unremitting. Well, 31, however, the use of the two together is designed to heighten the force of what is said. And the addition of the adjective adialaitos, unceasing, unremitting, indicates that Paul was always burdened by the reality of the negative volition of his Jews. When you pour your heart out to people, when you invest in their lives, you get invested in it. You can't help it. I don't care what kind of leader you are not a good leader if you're not involved with your people. And that involves having to shepherd them through difficult things, straightening them out when they're wrong, rebuking them when necessary, encouraging them when they're down, showing mercy when they need it, and all of that. And of course, in an ideal world, you'd have a perfect leader. Unfortunately, you got me. So we just have to do the best we can with what we do. But I can tell you as a communicator, and I've done it for a long time, even the 5 or so years I did it as a fundy, you care about what you're doing. You can't just do this in a vacuum. At least I can't. I've never been able to. Things bother you. It hurts when people go negative, when they peel off. It hurts. And you carry this around with you. You never get rid of it fully. And every one of us will have our share of lupe by the time we get to the bema seat. You'll have your lupe list. I'll have mine. And the fact is, Paul, this bothers him. And to me, this to me says, this guy is spiritually normal. This is how he should feel. Because he knows his nation is frittering away their inheritance, frittering away their standing with God through their refusal to believe, their rejection of Messiah. And that bothers him. It bothers me to watch our country do the things they do. But spiritually, it bothers him too. I mean, he's not just emotionally involved with it but from a national standpoint. But, I mean, obviously more it's from a spiritual standpoint. That he hates seeing this. I never have had any desire, really, to see anybody go to hell. Now, there are people I do not like, but I don't wish hell on them. I think you'd have to be pretty hard and cruel and all that to do that. You want the best for people. That's why Paul did what he did. That's why he suffered what he suffered. He wanted the best for his countrymen. And also for believers under his charge, which now includes Gentiles. He's got to factor that in too. Well, 32, the final comment about the heart indicates that this emotion was something that came from his innermost being. I have great sorrow, an unceasing grief in my heart, which makes it impossible to escape. This grief was his constant companion. So as you're going through life, I mean, the Christian life is a bit of a dichotomy on several fronts, but specifically when it comes to joy and lupe, joy and sorrow. The Christian life is characterized by both, the normal Christian life. You're going to have great joy over people who make it, people who apply, people who you think of them and you smile. That's fine. Then you're going to have the others, the group that doesn't make it. You think of them and you frown and they're bummers. And you can't do anything about it. But you have this in your life at various stages and at various times and in various proportions. Sometimes the joy greatly overwhelms the suffering and the lupe. Other times the lupe is all you can take. It's all you can bear with. It overpowers the joy. It makes you wonder if God's still in this. Is he for you? Has he given up? Has he changed his mind? Has he written me off? Maybe I've become such an idiot I don't even know it. And that's a legitimate fear a believer ought to have. I mean, we ought to legitimately fear falling short of God and his plan. So again, this grief, it's constant. It's unremitting. It's there all the time. No matter when things are going well, and Paul's seeing great numbers of people come to Christ. He was happy about that, but still there's that gnawing emptiness that, oh man, my nation's going down. And Paul, I think, had enough doctrine to know that eventually the nation was going to come under complete destruction. That was coming. He didn't necessarily know when. Any more than he knew when the rapture was. He didn't know for certain. But then it gets started in 66 and culminated in 70 A.D. Well, 33, as is evident here, one of the most painful things in life is to have others misrepresent one's true feelings and intentions. However, this is one aspect of the sufferings of Christ, which every believer will experience at some point in his Christian life. People will distort your words. They will misinterpret your motives. One of the things that you want to avoid as a believer, watch it when you find yourself imputing motive, because you cannot read the mental attitude. None of us can. So when you hear yourself thinking or saying out loud, well, I know you think blah, blah, blah. First, you don't know what I think. No man knows the thoughts of a man except the spirit of a man which is in him. And only those to whom you choose to reveal yourself really know what you think. And so this deal of don't impute motive, that's critical. That's what sinful judging is. It's saying, I knew what they thought and I knew why they did it. Now, you might be right, but you still violated the sinful judging thing. So you put yourself out of fellowship even if you're right. So again, only things we can really truly judge is what we see, what we hear, the things that are obvious to us, really. We can't impute motive. We can't judge mental attitudes. But again, everybody, you're going to have this happen. People are going to misjudge you. They're going to say all manner of evil against you sometimes. They're going to misrepresent your positions. This is why we strive so hard. That I don't want you going out of here as a believer and having, first, I don't want you having wrong positions. I don't want to have wrong positions. Again, I know the insistence on being right. Yeah, that's kind of important. Because again, if you don't think the right things, you're not going to do the right things most likely. It'll be rare that you didn't think the right thing and you did the right thing. Because the thought is the parent of the deed. So the reality is here, again, you're going to have people come at you. It's part of the sufferings. You just have to endure it. And chalk it up to undeserved suffering. Try not to take it personal. I know it's hard not to. If you're a human being and you have emotions, it's hard not to take things personally sometimes. But realize, hopefully, that, you know, maybe they didn't mean it personally. Hopefully they didn't. Hopefully they're not just cruel. But that's just the nature of the beast you're going to face. This is a part of our sufferings in Christ, in time. Well, 34, while it is natural to want to be understood and represented properly by others, there is no promise that such will always be the case. Psalm 56:5. It'd be nice if everybody was always nice, always represented exactly what you think, but they don't. Believers have experienced this in past generations. It goes on today and will still happen in the future, most likely. All day long, verse 5, they distort my words. All their thoughts are trained against me for evil. They attack, they lurk, they watch my steps. And they have waited to take my life. And so he prays, you know, God, take care of them. And he doesn't pray it nicely. Cast them forth in anger, put down the peoples, O God. You have taken account of my wanderings, put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your book? Again, I don't like the fact that they, here, if you think God has a literal bottle up there where he stores up tears, he doesn't. But this is a poetic way, again, not a technical way, a poetic way of saying, I have a lot of pain and grief in all of this. Because many of these people, and of course, and this is in David's case, this is a situation in which he's under discipline because of Bathsheba. But those people who didn't like David to start with, or didn't care for him, or whatever, that have kind of bided their time and lurked in the background, now they come out in full force. When David's under discipline, they show their colors. They want to come out and kick him when he's down. And that's painful to David. These are people, he was their king. Whatever their deal was, I mean, and I no doubt he had not done them intentionally wrong. I doubt that. The only person I know he did intentionally wrong, he killed. So that's really wrong. And then he wouldn't confess. He wouldn't acknowledge it. He wouldn't acknowledge his murder of Uriah and his adultery with Bathsheba. And so God was slowly but surely, he was under discipline and judgment. This is when people really want to come at you. When you're down and you're at a low spot. Then you'll find out, well, who your friends really are and who they really aren't. And how quick they can turn on you. Doesn't take long. Well, 35, in these situations, one can only humbly, and that's a big part of it here. I don't sense arrogance here in Paul. I don't see him saying, oh my God, they better stop and listen to me. I'm right and they're wrong. And this. I don't see any of that in this. I just see a real acknowledgement of pain, of sorrow, because he understands what they're missing out on. That ultimately they are condemning themselves to an eternity apart from God. The very God that selected their nation in a unique way. That's what they're doing. So again, you have to be willing to humbly explain your position. They may not accept it. This is one of the things, you know, there's a bunch of exhortations in the Bible to pastors about doing stuff and saying stuff like, proclaim these things with all authority. Let no man disregard you. Well, can I really stop people from disregarding me? I really can't. But the point is, you try to present the thing in such a way to make it hard for them to. And if you humbly sit there and say, look, I'm not your enemy. I may have issues with something you've done. Okay, let's discuss that if you want to. Because you're going to, from time to time, you're going to have issues with things people do. But it's how you work through these things. It's how you resolve the conflicts that are going to make all the difference. And so Paul just humbly explains his position and leaves the matter to God. And that's really all you can do. While personal vindication may or may not come in this light, God will ultimately vindicate the truth. So the fact is, we have to just wait for God. And again, see the doctrine of vindication. What does the doctrine of vindication teach? Don't pursue vindication. Let God vindicate you. And that may not happen in this life. See, that's another problem believers get into. And it's a normal human function. I understand it. You want people to understand when you are right. But again, you can't want that more than anything else. That personal vindication, you just have to learn to wait on. And if God doesn't vindicate you in this life, well, then the vindication in the next one's probably going to be pretty spectacular. I mean, I'm presuming you've done it right. And that's really what we're here for, to try to teach the doctrine that leads to godliness so you can live a life that pleases God and be blessed, both in time and ultimately in eternity. And that's what it's here for. That's what it's all about. Okay, well, I've got about 6 minutes here, so I'm just going to stop. I don't want to dive into this next verse. We might be able to get the exegesis done is all we'd get. So we'll pick up with verse 3 on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for this time together. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.